overlooked tips and techniques on episode 420 of the Actual Astronomy Podcast, not the Cheech and Chong edition. I'm Chris, and joining me is Shane. We are amateur astronomers who love looking up at the night sky, and this podcast is for everyone who enjoys going out under the stars. So episode 420, Shane. Yay.
Almost aligned with like April 20th.
It is. Like, we are recording this on the 21st. Yesterday was 420. So I'm sure people were in parks all over for those that partake in that, which is legal in our country, but not in many others. I was out here at my cabin working on pipes and boring Shane with that before we recorded. So that's what I was doing. Those are the kind of pipes that I'm working on, not the other one. It's all good. We have a new Patreon. Yeah, exactly. And you're a cigar smoker, so but we won't go into that. New Patreon supporter.
Yes. Thank you, Royce. Thank you for becoming a Patreon supporter. And thank you to all of our supporters. We really appreciate it. Helps keep everything moving in the right direction here.
Yeah. And Dave Chapman as well. We should thank him.
I saw that this morning. Yeah. Thanks, Dave. Appreciate your contributions as well.
Yeah. Appreciate that. It does help. It helps keep us going. We kind of had to clear out our bills. It helps to keep it going in many ways, because we don't get into that business of, you know, like we did the first year or so, who's paying for what and just trying to sort it out, which is fine for a year or so. But that could definitely wear on two guys trying to make a podcast together for many years.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, for sure.
So it's nice when we don't have to worry too much about, you know, who's paying for what bill. We just put it on the credit cards and then eventually sort it out some months later, it seems sometimes.
Yeah.
It's all good. It's all good. But we do certainly do appreciate it. And it definitely comes in handy. So I had an email from Maurice. Actually, I've been chatting him quite a bit over email because he's a sketcher as I am. And so we've been chatting about sketching and a few other things. And he sent us this email. Shane, maybe I'll just do a read of it, and then we can sort of leap off his idea.
Sounds good.
Hiya, Chris and Shane. I've been making my way through the back catalog of episodes that you guys have recorded. I always enjoy hearing how different people navigate the night sky. Knowing the sky well enough to rough out locations from memory like Chris does is my new what superpower would you want to have answer. But until I get to that point, I'll have to rely on star charts and software, which I still do. I'm not going to mince words. I wanted to pass on two insights on my own star navigation that I hadn't heard mentioned on the show or on Cloudy Nights and thought they might be useful. I'm not sure if this is worth trying to explain on the show. We're going to do that anyway, but I'm just throwing them out to you both to see if these are common things and I was just unaware of it. Maybe they'll be helpful to everybody. The first is the apparent field of view guide, or AFOV guide. I love using paper charts and generally try to keep things as analog as I can when observing. I always feel more connected with the night sky that way, particularly after a long day at work staring at screens. I can appreciate that. As a newbie observer, the one thing I found difficult was relating the chart scale to what I see in the eyepiece. To that end, I cut out a little guide to help orient myself with what I should expect to see. Basically, it's just three circles cut out of a piece of paper to the apparent field of view of my three most used star hopping setups. The big circle is 5 degrees and mimics the spotting scope on my 10-inch knob. The 1.5 degree circle approximates what I see through my 102 ED with the Bader at 24 millimeters. And that's a 1 degree setting circle, or 1 degree circle, that works to mimic the same zoom in my 10-inch knob. I've only been observing with telescopes for about 4 months now and assume that as I get more comfortable with the setups, this reference may become less necessary. But for me right now, they are extremely helpful. Coming up with this technique was inspired by the NFB, which is the National Film Board of Canada documentary, which people can look up. I think it's called This 1960 Documentary Recreates the Universe as It Would Appear to a Voyager Barreling Through Space, or something like that. And the awesome puck that the astronomers use to pinpoint a target. I love the aggressively cool tool they used when plunking it down on the map. I'm still making I'm still thinking of making something a bit more substantial to replace the paper cutout circles, just because this thing looks so damn cool. Okay, so maybe let's dive into his number one apparent field of view guide. So for me, Shane, it's like knowing the night sky and being able to kind of navigate through so many objects. It's just comes with experience. I think you're the same as is Mike. It's sort of a skill I think that most people develop to a certain extent. But is there anything that you've done in your own observing that has helped to facilitate kind of knowing where things are in the night sky without having to reference charts and such?
Largely experience. And then the other part of it would be some preparation just ahead of my session. You know, I typically, before I go outside to actually observe, I'll have an idea of, you know, a handful of objects that I want to look at. Depending on the time I plan to be out there, it might just be one or two objects, but it could be 5 to 10, depending on how long the night will be. Mm-hmm. And so, you know, knowing which objects I want to look at, I might use Sky Safari or one of my star chart books, like the Pocket Sky Atlas, just to locate it there. Something you and I have talked about in the past is using those post-it note arrows.
Yeah.
So, you know, that you can mark up your chart and it's non-permanent, and that just kind of helps you, or helps me anyway, know where I want to point the telescope. But I really like his use of these field of view templates to apply to the star charts. The Sky Atlas 2000, I think it's the desk version, comes with an overlay with Telrad circles. And I think there's some like field of view things there too, which is super handy. I really like that for planning.
Yeah, I've seen this done differently. I haven't seen anybody do it quite like this. I'd be curious to see, if he can make a go of this set of images like he has, or these set of circles like he has on the paper. I think that's pretty cool. I hadn't seen anybody do it quite like that before. More of a tool. The thing that I've seen people before, and there is a Sky and Telescope online article about this, and I remember when it was even in the magazine, but they took like a little bit of copper or brass wire, and they made like these nice little circles that you could just kind of drop down on your paper at night, that they're not going to blow away, kind of like this piece of paper might on Royce. I think that... if he could weight it somehow, I think that's why it's weighted, so it doesn't blow around. It was kind of, I get what he's saying about like sort of the aesthetics of having sort of almost like that hockey puck type thing that you could just sort of drop, but it's kind of not going to go anywhere when the wind picks up as it has here just now. But for sure, just having that piece of paper, it's probably going to go flying and become sort of a tree ornament somewhere downwind of me if I was using that. So yeah, that's pretty cool. But I know that Clark Muir, my buddy Clark from Ontario, he did that at one point in time, made some sort of circles out of coat hanger or something, although that seems like it would be overly thick and difficult to work with. But he had made some at one point in time. I definitely can see it as being useful. I think especially at night, the one thing that we often forget when we're sitting around, and it's always hard to get one's mind around, is how difficult it becomes to navigate and using star charts at night in the dark when you're tired is supremely challenging. It really is. And anything that helps to facilitate that, sort of sitting here in the daytime, I think, you know, how useful is this? Well, like in the daytime sitting at your desk, it's sort of like an interesting thing to take a look at. But at night under the sky, when you're tired and it's late and all this stuff, I think it does become supremely useful to have that. I would like to have something of this nature. I think that would be pretty cool.
Yeah. The other thing you and I have talked about many, many times when we've been out observing is some star charts have a better, like relatable scale to the sky. And you know, as much as I love the Pocket Sky Atlas, and I really do love it, I find that one sucks sometimes. When you look at the star placement on the chart, I always think that it makes it look like everything's closer than it really is in the sky. And then when I look up in the sky, I'm like, oh, wow, that's a way bigger jump than I was expecting. So I think for that one, like for the Pocket Sky Atlas, a little template like this would be really handy.
Yeah, and so now we're transitioning into, I think, something that Royce is tiptoeing around. He probably has realized this already. If not, he's going to realize it pretty soon about this scaling and the night sky. I discovered this for myself probably about 20 years ago when I made a laminated copy of Barnard's photographic atlas of selected regions of the Milky Way, or whatever it's called. Anyhow, it has all these images of the night sky and then associated charts on sort of facing pages, or at least that's how I set it up. And then I was looking at it and it was cool. And I thought, well, how useful will this be? You know, we've got planetarium software that I was using and making charts from and everything. And I decided I would take it out under the night sky. Still have a copy of it. I'm going to put it in my observatory. It's massive. It weighs like 10 or 12 pounds. But it is supremely useful, way more so than I could have ever imagined. It completely blew me away because, as many are going to be aware, E.E. Barnard, who created it, and as well, like reference to his niece, last name of Calvert, can't remember her first name. But that chart, or that set of charts that went along with the images, and the images themselves were taken from the perspective of a visual observer. See, whenever we do our monthly show, you'll recall, Shane, often we talk about holding your fist up at arm's length to the nighttime sky in reference to your fist spanning 10 degrees across the sky, right? You recall this. And that, in essence, is very close to what your chart should represent, held at arm's length, sort of as you're standing over the chart with your red light, so long as you don't have to like zoom in too close, held at arm's length or at some sort of distance, that perspective should be, in a way, what you see, at least if you're trying to use like a finder scope or binoculars or something like that. Of course, as you're using bigger and bigger instruments, that scale will change. But like what Royce is hinting at here, by using that low power in association with the chart, that scaling needs to be at a particular scale. It's not at a random scale. Although I think like with the Pocket Atlas, they did go with some sort of compromise. I'd be curious to see what the Jumbo Pocket Atlas is like. Part of me thinks that's probably why they made it. But Sky Atlas 2000 works pretty good like this. It's a little bit zoomed in. And then the Interstellarium is a little bit more zoomed in itself, but maybe, yeah, give or take, it's not quite. I think a fist is like 6 degrees on that or something like that, but it's close and it works really well for your finder scope, right? Arm's length, 5 degrees, fist, 5 degrees, 6 degrees on the chart. It's not like a random scaling. This is where the software fails. And although Royce is just mentioning that he prefers the aesthetic and the enjoyment of getting away from screens and whatever, and that's awesome. This is also the warning for people that are trying to use software under the night sky, because I've done it and I couldn't believe how much I struggled using the software with the night sky. I think it's getting better, but it doesn't do the proper scaling because you can zoom in and zoom out sort of infinitely. It's very difficult to get that scaling right because typically on the device, your fist would be massive. So you're zoomed way out, too far out. And then that perspective is off so much. It's not enabling you to learn the night sky. It's better than nothing, but it's certainly not great. I could never get mine to match. I spend way too much time trying to mess around to get that scaling to match in the software. And then just the way the eye works with a screen under low light, for me, it's never worked very well, even when I was a younger person. But anyway, those are my thoughts on that. I think the idea of having circles that represent your fields of view for your particular charts, I think that this is not just something that's useful for a newbie or a beginner. I think this is a very handy thing to have for anybody. Shane, thoughts?
For sure. Yeah, I want one.
Yeah. Because we all have Interstellarum.
I like your comment though about, being paper, it could disappear in the wind or whatever. So having something made of aluminum or just something weighted would be handy, but I certainly love the idea.
I might see if once my builder gets far enough along, we have all this extra wood. I wonder if he could make me one out of wood. That'd be cool. I think that would look pretty neat.
Yeah, for sure.
Drill a few holes and yeah, he likes doing stuff like that. You should see the chart holder he made for me. It's ridiculous. It would be pretty cool to get him to make like a set of the circles for each chart, and then I could have like little hangers for each of them. He would be totally down. This is the type of a person he is. This is right up his alley. I'm going to see if he'll do that eventually once we get water lines working and power run and all this other crazy stuff out here. But yeah, Royce also talked about setting the iPhone screen to red. He did give me, wonder if I can share my screen and if we can play that. Should we try this or is this too risky?
Go for it.
All right, we'll give this a try. So Royce made us a little video. Hopefully he's okay if we play it. I'm gonna make sure that when I share this though, I'm gonna do the share sound as well because that will actually play it. And now asking me for my password, which I do not remember. See if this works. Oh, all right. We're going to try it. We're going to see if this will play. Do you see it now, Shane?
Yep.
This is a little video tutorial of how I get my red screen on here always for the phone. You know how when you turn it on, sometimes the glare of that will totally mess up your night vision. But I found a way to set it so you can tap your power button 3 times and it turns every screen red, so you have a red tint over all of it, and then you just adjust the brightness way, way down. I, at least in my Portal 7 skies, I never have an issue with this being too bright. I haven't been to a super dark site, so I'm assuming that it might be a little too bright for that. But in most cases, I feel like a lot of folks might get a lot of advantage out of this because you can switch around to anything, throw on Distellarium, and you don't have to worry about any of the accidental flashes of white light. Now to get to this, I'm going to switch back to normal for a second. All you have to do two adjustments to the settings. The first one is they're both in accessibility. So if you go into the settings here and down to accessibility, the first thing to do is to change the color of what the screen is going to switch to, and that is in display and text sizes. And we go down near the bottom, and there's a color filters. Right now it's off, but you can choose all different colors, and then if you press the switch, it turns it on and off. Now we can also set that to the quick 3-click thing if you want it to be a little bit easier, so you don't have to pop all the way to this setting all the time by just going in the accessibilities again, all the way near the bottom here, there is accessibility shortcut. And click that. You just choose whichever one you want. In this case, it's color filters. And then we can do the 3-tap thing and it automatically turns to red. You never have to worry about it. Every time your screen turns on, it's always red. Okay, hopefully that's helpful. Bye.
I thought that was pretty cool.
Yeah, it is neat. Those instructions apply to iPhone. Not sure how you would do that on an Android, but I'm sure it's quite possible because those ones are even more, you have more ability to customize everything on those ones. So.
Yeah, people should be able to look it up, but it seems like most people are iPhone users, according to my long-term survey on the subject for work-related activities. Royce says, although I love using paper charts, I must admit I've been using my iPhone with Stellarium more and more because of its ability to customize the map settings. In the beginning, I experienced a lot of night vision issues you often bring up on the show. Getting past the lock screen was always a pain. That is until I found this hack. So that's, yeah, this is useful. I need to use my phone to do a couple things in my observatory before I get going. I'm definitely going to be using this. This is super helpful, at least for me. I think it will be for other people as well. So hopefully that sound came through. There's a quick setup you can do in the iPhone that allows you to use a 3-button click. Yeah, we talked about that and went through the video. So I'm not going to read that section. In writing this up, Royce goes on to say, I'm wondering if there's something in maybe doing a tips and techniques episode with all the little things that sometimes get overlooked in the broader discussion of observing. There are so many little things that I've heard that folks do, using fanny packs to hold eyepieces, putting shower caps on the bottom of the daub to keep dust out, printing your setting circles, eye patch techniques, or maybe that's just too random and overwhelming for an episode. Just random thought. As always, thanks for the fantastic work, Royce. Thanks for this, Royce. This is awesome.
Yeah, really good. And I like the idea for a topic, which we're going to dive into today.
Yes, this is, we're even doing it now. I really like the one on the iPhone. Shane, I feel like you're the person who has so many little tips and tricks. Why don't you hop in and get going with yours?
Sure. So we've done a few episodes in the past sort of related to this. So I went a little deeper into the well for this one, trying to think of what are some other things that I do that I probably haven't talked about or haven't talked too much about. And, but I do it almost every time, you know, that I'm outside observing. So my list starts with, and really this is in no particular order. But my first one here is a lanyard for my flashlight, and it's a, you know, a lanyard that can go around my neck. And ever since my first red flashlight that I got, which was a Skywatcher one with a wheel that, you know, allows you to variably dim the light to whatever level you want, it came with a lanyard on, and, you know, you put it around your neck. And ever since then, I just can't live without a lanyard. And there's a couple of reasons why I really value that on my flashlight. The first one is then I always know where my flashlight is. It's, you know, it's around my neck. It's very accessible. And, you know, I don't have to go fishing through my pocket to try to find it. And then the other reason why I really like the lanyard is, like after I look at every object, I like to write down my observation log on a pad of paper. And, you know, if you have it at sort of the right length around your neck, you just turn it on and it's pointing down. So it's not going to disrupt any other observers, but then it illuminates my notepad and I can easily, you know, record my, my observation. So it works really well for that. And then I also use it, just to illuminate my star charts, sort of same idea. I don't have to hold my flashlight. It's just pointed downwards and I, you know, can put the star chart kind of underneath the light, see what I want to see, and away I go. So I really enjoy that. And the lanyard that I have right now actually has sort of a, like an adjustable, I don't know, tensioner thing on the back of it. So I can adjust it to whatever length I want once it's around my neck, which is handy because sometimes if they hang too low, it's just not conducive to the use cases that I just said. So that one is pretty important to me.
Okay. And can I just dive in a little bit on this
one?
A little bit?
Yeah.
What red flashlight or flashlights are you using or have you found to be best?
I've only, like, I really haven't played around with a bunch of different lights. So for the longest time, I was using the Skywatcher one that I just mentioned, and, it's a red light, LED as well as white LED. And there's a toggle switch to go between them. And then like that potentiometer to vary the light output, runs on a 9-volt and it served me quite well. I sort of got annoyed with it towards the end. Like it still works and I still have it, but the light that came from it wasn't a consistent flood. Like it was sort of spotty and sometimes that potentiometer was a little touchy. Like, you know, it wouldn't, like it would go from very dim and then all of a sudden it would seem to jump to a brighter level. So anyway, I started to look for something else. And right around that time, you and I started talking about amber lights instead of red lights because amber allows, like, your eye just works better with an amber light. So, like, looking at star charts or lists, it's just easier on your eye. So, trying to find an amber flashlight that also has like a potentiometer or some sort of a, you know, like infinitely dimmable setting type of thing is very difficult. In fact, I couldn't really find one. So what I ended up buying was it's a jet beam flashlight and it's the RRT01, Raptor, I think.
Oh.
It's kind of a mouthful, and it's just a normal flashlight. In fact, it's quite a bright flashlight, but it has this ring on it that you can dim it to whatever level you want. So I bought that, and then I bought some gel amber overlays to put on it to get it to that amber light, which I really, really liked. But the beam on it is a bit of a like a it's a bit of a spotlight. It's not a floodlight. So then what I did is I bought an overlay that you would just put on a window, like for privacy glass, and it makes it opaque. And what that does is it distributes the light. So it's less of a spot and more of a floodlight. So now I've been using that for probably the last year or two, and I love it. It's fantastic. It just works really, really well.
For me, I had gotten one of these for free. I think when I bought my Takahashi, I was like, I want something for free though. And I think Stefan sent this to me, and it's a skylight by Rigel Systems. And he just sent me a red one because I think somebody had picked it up in the store and broken a small piece of plastic off of it, which impacts nothing to do with the light at all. It just aesthetically, if you were to sell it to somebody as new, it's not amazing. You kind of like, why did you send me a one with a piece of broken plastic on it? But I don't care. It doesn't impact the use of it at all. And I loved it so much, I went and bought like the deluxe version, but I actually don't like the deluxe version as much. And I've gone back to using this one, and I'm going to go and buy a couple more. And they are very inexpensive, $25 USD, which is about the going rate for all of them. But the thing that I like about these mini LED red lights from Rigel Systems is that they are very small. They come with a lanyard, although I put a huge, brilliant green lanyard on mine because I kept losing my lights, and I love this one. And they're square, so that if I do need to use them when sketching, they're small and square. They're very easy to place on your sketching book and then to hold there. They're almost like stay put on their own, just the way that they're built. So they're sort of perfect for my type of observing. They're not very bright though, and I like that. So they seem to be much dimmer than all the other lights, and just like the nature of it, I always end up like just spinning the dials because I'm like, whatever. So when I turn my red light on, I end up with it too bright a lot of the time, just because of the way I am, I guess. I don't know. I should think about these things more, but it's just the way things go, like when you're trying to do stuff. So I think it's best if you have like a really bright regular red light for when you're looking around doing stuff. But then when you're actually doing the astronomy, reading your charts, trying to sketch whatever, have a nice dim one. You've gone to some great links there describing yours. I think that's pretty cool. But I do really like these Rigel Mini LEDs. That's what I'd like to use. Anyway, just thought I'd put that into end of our show here since you raised it. Pretty cool. What's your next thing? You're talking about a special pen or something?
Yeah, so again, I like to write down my observation right at the eyepiece as I'm doing my session. And you know, especially here, like spring and fall, it can get a little chilly at night, you know, sometimes below freezing. And like a regular ink pen, as it cools, that ink just starts to freeze up, or it thickens up, and it doesn't flow very well. So there's been multiple nights earlier on in my observing history where I would have to stop logging my observations because my pen quit working, or I'd have to like heat up my pen so that the ink would flow. But that's easy to overcome. If you get a pressurized ink cartridge, probably better known as like those space pens, the Fisher space pens, they work in all temperatures. They work upside down. You know, they just work in all conditions. They're made for extreme environments. So you can get them in a number of different, you know, sizes and sort of pens. The Fisher pens are probably the most popular ones. They have inserts that go into like the Parker jotters, and they work great for astronomy purposes. It's probably not the best laid down ink, like it won't compare to a high-end pen or cartridge, but it's just perfect for astronomy. And you know, I actually went to a like I started using a pencil because I thought, well, you know, that's the way you solve this, because a pencil will operate in any condition as well. But I just found that, like, unless I, you know, would have like a fairly dark pencil, it just didn't show up very well with a red light. And mm-hmm. it was kind of hard to see what I was actually writing. And then, you know, I need a pencil sharpener or a mechanical pencil. And I just, none of that really appealed to me. So pressurized ink cartridge, high nice. On my list. Yeah.
Nice. What's next? What do you got here next?
Yeah, just I put Nanook or Pelican cases for my eyepieces. And I have a number of different cases. And the reason I'm saying this is a few different reasons. One, just protection. You know, there's a good investment of money and sometimes even like time to find some rare eyepieces that I want them, you know, free from damage and with a lid that I can close in the field so that they don't accumulate dew or anything like that throughout the night. Mm-hmm. So those are sort of the practical reasons, but the other is, it's just easy to walk out of the house. I grab the case that I want and away I mm-hmm. go. So, you know, I put a little note here, really it's anything that contributes to getting me outside faster or with mm-hmm. less trips, because that becomes a barrier. So like just something as simple as a shoulder strap for my eyepiece cases really, really helps, because then I can sling the eyepiece case over my shoulder and I have both hands free to grab whatever else I need. So, mm-hmm. you know, if I'm about to go outside in the backyard, you'll see a Pelican case, you know, over my shoulder, tripod in one hand with mount and telescope on there. And then in the other hand is my Berlebach observing chair. And it's basically then I'm one trip out the door and I'm, you know, ready to observe. So mm-hmm. Again, it's small, but it's kind of a quality of life thing that really, that I really appreciate.
Cool.
Yeah.
Very cool.
Next one here on my list is a red dot finder. And this one is not, you know, super unique or shocking, I think, to anybody. But I really do like red dot finders over any other kind of finder. Mm-hmm. And I'm still using a red dot finder, even though I'm using the Nexus digital setting circles. And the reason, or one of the reasons why I like a red dot finder, is it just gets you to where you want to point your telescope very quickly. And then I find that I don't need to use like a finder eyepiece. Mm-hmm. You know, before red dot finders, I would point my telescope in the general area I want to be, but you know, I would need a 30 to 40 millimeter 2-inch eyepiece in there to give me a real wide field of view to make sure I'm, you know, kind of in the area that I want to be and I can find my object. But mm-hmm. with a red dot, I can be more accurate and then put in like a 15 to 20 millimeter eyepiece, which, you know, gives me a little more power, maybe frames the object better, and I'm not having to mess around switching with eyepieces, you know, back and forth between a finder eyepiece and then a more powerful eyepiece.
Mm-hmm.
And you can get a lot of different red dot finders, like there's the Telrads.
Mm-hmm.
They're quite nice, but I find them to be a little large. If you're using a Dobsonian or a Newtonian or Cassegrain, anything like that, they're great. But for some of the smaller refractors that I'm into, they're just a little too large. I really do like the Rigel quick finders. It's basically like a Telrad, but much more compact. But I do like that, like the Rigel has the variable brightness on it. So you can really dial that in for whatever kind of sky you're looking at.
Mm-hmm.
So those ones are pretty nice. And then, probably what I have more of, just about every telescope maker has these, but it's like a little metal red dot finder that, I think is actually, I think the origin of it might be for like small rifles, but, easily adapts to a telescope. There's a brightness dial on there from like 0 to 10 or something like that. So you can get it fairly dim, although even at its dimmest, it's probably still a little too bright. But those ones also have, usually 3 to 4 different reticles that you can change. So, you know, kind of pick the reticle that works best for you. Mm-hmm. And, I find those to be, again, just a super handy thing to have. Really, really speeds up me finding objects.
Nice.
Yeah. Yeah. Next one here. I've talked a little bit about this in the past too, but not a lot, but like having some sort of tripod caddy Or like a tray for your tripod. So
Do you mean like somebody that comes along and joins you when you're observing to hand you your, I'll take the 7 millimeter Jeeves kind of, no?
recommend eyepieces for me for whatever lay I have on the fairway.
I recommend the 5 millimeter on Jupiter tonight, sir.
But having something like that is just another quality of life thing. Like once you're out there, if you have a tray or a tripod caddy, it just gives you a place to put filters or a couple of extra eyepieces that you're using throughout the night, or even sometimes your charts. And it's just handy because it's right there. And then the other thing that I put on this line was just pockets, like a jacket with some pockets, or again, just to put eyepieces or like, my notepad and my pen. Sometimes you want to have a snack. Sometimes you have like 1.25 to 2 inch adapters. All of that kind of stuff you may or may not use throughout the night, but it's handy to have like kind of quick access to, so that you don't have to keep getting up and going inside or going to some other location to get your gear. So I always try to make sure I have some storage on me and some storage on my tripod, which just helps me enjoy the session a little bit more. And then
Awesome.
the last item that I have here, Chris, really kind of feeds into what I just talked about, but it's also nice to have like a portable table. Because sometimes when you go out observing, you might be going to just an open field or some place that's not purpose-built for astronomy. And when you're bringing an eyepiece case and a bottle of water and charts and all of this kind of stuff, it's nice to have somewhere to set it, and just having a little table that folds up is super, super handy. You can get these things from pretty much any camping store or any store that sells outdoor items. Usually there's some sort of folding portable table that you can buy. Sometimes they're made of fabric, sometimes they're made of metal. And I just find these super, super useful. And even when we go down to like the grasslands, like there's picnic tables and there's all that kind of stuff there, but I still bring my portable table because
That
where
stuff is never in the right spot.
exactly, yeah, like where you want your telescope could be 15 feet away from the table. So now you're kind of where are you going to put all your stuff? Well, if you bring the table, then you're covered. So I really enjoy that.
Cool. Yeah, I think out of these, I think the one that I think I enjoy the most is the portable table. Because I'll say this, there's a handful of things that we've talked about over the years, but we haven't put them all together. And I didn't really have these together for this, but definitely the table. I bought one. Boy, I gotta say, I think it was like $19, maybe they're $29. It has like almost like an ironing board scissor type set of legs for it. So it doesn't work really work amazing on surfaces that aren't that level, but it's fine. And the top is plastic. It's maybe 18 or 20 inches by 36 or 40 inches or something like that. So it's not huge, but it's perfect. It's all you need: chart, eyepieces, bottle of water. You can have all your stuff right there. It's not too big, just the right size for astronomy. Super useful just for camping in general. Love it. Wouldn't observe without it. Not really observing gear though. You can pick it up at any hardware store, game, like inexpensive, $30. It's a game changer. Reclining lawn chair for observing with binoculars. Also, not really astronomy specific, but it is that is a game changer as well. And then the observing chair. Almost in that order ish. But I think having the table, the reclining chair, the observing chair, these really, really make huge, huge differences when you're out at dark sites trying to observe for several hours. The difference between having a sore back or sore knees or whatever at the end of the night and really just being comfortable and be able to go with an extra hour or so.
Agreed.
Anyway, I'm just throwing that in. I wasn't really part of this, but that really got me thinking. I think the table is very, very key. Very, very key. So my overlook tips, I really laughed at this one. I put my long underwear on here. Number one, high quality polypropylene if you can get it, or some really good Stanfield's underwear. I'm from the hometown of John Stanfield, where the underwear factory is. And I have a full suit of it that I'll even put on. It's light, and take it with me. And like I took it with me to Hawaii and threw that on before I observed. It was awesome, kept me totally warm. Because when you're out at night, even when it's fairly comfortable, if you're just out for 5 minutes or sitting around a fire, when you're out just observing, sitting still in the cold night air, your body just chills. Like almost like it would have to be really warm not to chill, eh?
Oh yeah, absolutely. You can't really understate how valuable insulation is when you're observing, because it really is shocking. Like even, like for us, like right now or last night when I was out for a little bit, I think it was about +5, which usually isn't too bad during the daytime if the sun is on you, but at night when you're not moving and there's no sun and there might be a little bit of a breeze, oh my, that'll chill you to the bone real fast.
Yeah, for sure. So yeah, having proper attire, and in particular like the really good high-end expensive long underwear, nothing beats it. Like it just you can observe comfortably for hours. And man, like being cold observing, that is the worst thing. And I'll even throw it in because I can get by with some lighter fare over top. If I have that, like in the summer, like sometimes I'll just throw it on and then just jeans and t-shirt, sweater, and take my coat and hat and gloves along with me. And often, even just wearing that, I can go pretty far. And I don't look any different than anybody else out in the observing field. But I remember I went back to Nova Scotia once and it was really damp, but it was actually pretty good conditions. And everybody was like going to bed. I'm like, whoa, like what's going on? But I was. Just from observing out here and being a little bit more prepared, like I was good. I went to bed, I was nice and warm, but people were like complaining about how cold it was and how difficult a time they had getting to sleep. But by having that set of very simple long underwear, just had thrown it on, didn't even think about it. Like I said, nobody could even tell I was wearing this thing. It just sort of like going back to Royce's original comment, kind of made you feel a bit like a superhuman, when everybody else was really starting to suffer, you were just laughing, right? You still just had your coat open kind of thing. It was pretty amazing. So, and that goes back, that gets you that extra hour. A lot of the time it is just getting an extra hour on under the stars. You start adding that in over, months and years of observing. And when you do get the extra hour here and there and everywhere, you do end up knowing the sky quite a bit better.
Yep, for sure.
Binoculars, I gotta say something about binoculars. Just the binoculars, reclining lawn chair, and I think many people do this, but for me, I learned the sky with binoculars because, well, that's really all I could afford. That's all I could get when I was in university, and so got the binoculars, and I would just go out and learn the night sky using binoculars. So, and with binoculars, you are really just learning the night sky. So perhaps a couple tips in one: learn the sky with binoculars first, and then keep using them to get your field down when you're hunting targets. Like I don't really use a finder scope much. I have a pretty good idea of where my telescope will point, and if I can find that spot in the sky with binoculars, then I can point my telescope there. But I just find like being able to have that flexibility of panning around with the binoculars is just so much better. I just can't state that enough. Not for everybody though. I think this could be very particular to me, but I think it is a good way to learn the sky using binoculars.
No, it is for sure.
Another one, this one com almost completely unrelated to astronomy, but this sort of I found it sort of accidentally is 1 year I just decided to give up alcohol just for whatever, and no real reason other than just give it up. And man, I couldn't believe how much more energy I had. And again, like being able to get up and get out and do more astronomy, much easier to get up in the mornings at 3 or 4 o'clock if you haven't, even like just having one drink, even a couple days before sometimes. I was pretty surprised. I feel like a bit of a hypocrite because I was having a beer yesterday afternoon, but we're going into new moon, so it's all good. Let's see. Yeah, and the having a snack with you, sort of like hydrating, having a snack with you, And this is the real nugget that I learned in all the nights I was out down in the grasslands. Like, one, like, yeah, if you are out in the heat in the day in the summer, like if you have alcohol and not hydrate as much, like you're really going to suffer at night. It's going to be pretty tough to actually do any astronomy. But then if you drink lots of water instead, the water helps the expansion and contraction of the cells of your body. And I think under normal situations, you might notice this a little bit, like if you're really tuned to it. But when you're out, like especially like camping or being out a lot outside and doing a strong trying to do astronomy at night later on that day, you will notice this. It's a pretty big difference in being well hydrated and then getting good sleep when you finally do go to bed and being warm. Being hydrated is pretty massive. Sounds like a silly thing, maybe something people are already aware of, but yeah, take that bottle of water, take that snack with you, like you said, Shane, and that can be a pretty big game changer, in my opinion, where again, you're able to get that extra hour and it's just a much more pleasant experience, is what it boils down to.
Yeah, it does make a difference. And, you know, what you're saying kind of just about general good health practices certainly does carry over into astronomy, you know, with energy and just ability to adapt to the outdoor temperatures too. All of that helps contribute to you being better.
Next one is about adaptation as well. And that is to, because I see this a fair bit, sort of starting with a lot of mine are sort of like subcategories because there's a few things at once, but being flexible and adaptable, like taking a more relaxed attitude on the weather. Because I know when I'm like reading people's reports, like mostly online or chatting with people, sometimes people can get really focused on what the weather might do. But like for me, I'm always like planning to get out and just to be out lots of observing, and eventually those good nights, they will just come to you. That's my experience, which is also that the best nights are unpredictable. Like it's pretty wild how many good nights you can get. We were chatting at the beginning of this podcast because yesterday was supposed to be +7 and totally overcast, not a hope of doing any observing. Now it was almost like full moon here. We're at 70%. However, we end up with totally clear skies. I went out, I was looking at M36, M38, M37, didn't do any sketches, kind of thought of it, took a long look at the moon, kind of tooled around a little bit. You know, was sort of like messing around with some gear a bit, but you know, I was out for like an hour or so just in between making up these podcast notes. And yeah, it was just one of those things where, you know, got that extra hour under the night sky that otherwise wouldn't have had. And again, like in my experience, those best nights are unpredictable. Like so many times I'm out and it does clear, and then I can get out and do an hour or three, even when it really wasn't supposed to be that great. Or sometimes it'll be forecast to clear off after midnight, and then it clears off at 10 or something like that. And you know, you get 2 hours in before midnight and go to bed. So just being adaptable to it and flexible with what the night gives you, that is key. Just more so my observing before I came here, when I used to observe with a lot more people, a lot more of the time, I would frequently run into people who would get super frustrated because the night didn't give them what they were hoping for, and then they really didn't get much quality observing in, and spent most of the time like bumming around and complaining, which kind of bugs me, sort of on a personal level. Maybe I shouldn't say this, but Mike and I, there's a good example. Mike and I made this huge plan for observing. We were going to observe all these different objects in the fall, and we had a couple awesome nights, but then like the following weekend just wasn't good enough to do the observing that we had hoped to do. We had this aurora, so we just changed. We just went on to globular clusters. So we observed all these globular clusters instead, and did some other observing, and it was awesome. We just had too much aurora and some thin cloud that was around, but just making use of those nights and being flexible, just switching targets. Sometimes you'd go out and like right now, like we have this. It was beautiful, clear when I get up, but now we have like this very thin haze or strato, not stratocumulus, but just stratus cloud, really. And if it was clear the moon is up, maybe looking at the moon or picking out some lunar targets, something like that. Just being flexible sometimes with what the sky gives you, Shane.
Yeah, I like that a lot, particularly around like the different, class of objects. It's one of the big reasons why I like to look at double stars because I can do that easily from light polluted areas. The moon is another great one. We curse it a lot, but when it's up and even if it's full, there's a lot to observe there. And there's a number of different observing programs to help you learn the moon by naming the objects and then having you observe them. So certainly flexibility and just kind of getting out under the sky is great advice.
I was channeling my inner Corey Hart last night. I had my polarizing sunglasses on while I was observing the moon. It was pretty bright.
Yeah, it was.
These hardcover books, this is my number five, hardcover books by Stillman and Byrne. They're expensive, but they're awesome because they're hard enough that you can clip on your light and some other stuff and not dispense with the whole clipboard thing. Like you can just use the clipboard itself and it just simplifies the process. They're beautiful paper. They're not inexpensive, but typically I think they're 50 pages single-sided, so you can use both sides. So you essentially have 100 pages there, which in my experience is about pretty good for an observing season. Usually I even have a few left over at the end of my observing season with those. So quite like those. The only thing I was struggling with and still have to fully set this up was organizing my pencils and pencils rolling around. But Royce, who inspired this edition of our podcast, came to my rescue here and sent me a link for a Lightfoot pencil holder, which is pretty nice. It's just like a little coil binding, comes with it's like a Velcro attachment. You can put it on different things. So I just got to kind of figure out how and where I'm going to attach that. I might go back to a clipboard and then just put it on the clipboard. Who knows? But that definitely will help out, especially in the observatory. I think should make things a lot easier up there. But yeah, those hardcover Stillman and Byrne books, and then using an orange Amazon reading light, they just clip on, and then you can put a layer or two of red duct tape over them to get them down to the right level. Works pretty good. Astronomy gear number six. I'm not a gear snob, but get the best quality you can afford instead of getting on the train to Brokesville. Shane, I see a lot of people online and they'll buy like $100 eyepieces before they would drop $300 on a really good eyepiece. Do you know what I mean?
Yeah, for sure. Earlier on in my days in astronomy, I definitely messed around with some less expensive gear just to see what it was all about. And it was a really good learning experience for sure. But I've definitely kind of shifted now and I'd rather save my pennies and target, whatever eyepiece it might be. If you want the Nagler 31, go for it, save your money, make the purchase, and you won't regret it. And it's then going to be something that probably stays in your collection for the rest of your lifetime, really.
Yeah, for me, I never really ever even owned that many eyepieces. I own 90% of the eyepieces ever bought. So probably have like 20 or maybe 24 eyepieces. And typically I buy one eyepiece, not quite every year. When I started out, I bought two or three in a Barlow. Two eyepieces in a Barlow is how I got started. And then it was years before I bought another eyepiece. Yeah, it's just not something I ever really get into. You only need three or four eyepieces anyway. And don't get me wrong, gear can be fun, but I just do get worried that beyond a certain point, I do see people kind of chasing this, unobtainable, inexpensive eyepiece. Buying sometimes 100 eyepieces for up to like 100 or 150 bucks, and it's just like whoa, because each one of those is yeah affordable, but you can easily spend into the thousands of dollars pretty quick as I'm sure some people have trying to find like this bargain performer. And I would just say, just buy that Pentax or Nagler or Ethos or Explore Science or whatever. Buy a few really good ones. And you don't have to. I see lots of like basically all the really good sketchers that I've seen are just using pretty regular eyepieces. Like Royce was talking about just using, I think it's like a better zoom. I know when Cindy was on, she was talking about just using, she wasn't really focused on the eyepieces. I know my friend Kathleen's an amazing sketcher, and she probably couldn't even tell you what eyepiece she has almost. And it's not a focus on the gear. It's a focus on, how you're doing that stuff. And again, like last night, I was out, just used 2 30 millimeter, 5 millimeter, so low power, get things in the field of view, and then pump up the power to 140x to zoom way in, either on the moon or these open clusters I was looking at. And that's it. Good eyepieces, but just like my low power is just a fancy Koenig from Japan, and then 5 millimeter Pentax, $500 worth of eyepieces, American, so pretty humble here, really, in many ways. But I just don't think it's worthwhile to try to buy and own, all these different eyepieces. I basically have almost the whole set of Pentaxes, but that's just some. I always wanted to own like a set of eyepieces, but that's just me. And I think Shane, I think I spent 20 years before I had that, so maybe not quite 18 years before I had that set. So that was sort of my long-term plan, but it wasn't like I went out and dropped $2,000 on them. But there's nothing wrong if somebody wants to do that. At the same time, I think you only need three or four. Thoughts?
Most nights, I probably go between two focal lengths of eyepieces, maybe three. Just because I don't want that to get in between me and observing. And I find if I'm messing around with different eyepieces all night, I'm just kind of wasting, not wasting time, but it's time I could be investing in finding another object or something like that. So you're right. You don't really need, every millimeter, increment of eyepiece for most observing nights. If you're doing some real critical planetary stuff, you want to maximize your magnification that the skies will allow you. So sometimes that use case, you'll want a few extra eyepieces with you. But yeah, most nights a high power eyepiece and a low power eyepiece will get you through.
Yeah, it doesn't need to be anything too wild. And I think the same thing, my advice holds for telescopes as well. I think beyond, like once you get going and decide that this is something you really want to do, like wherever you are and however long that takes, whether it takes you, a few months or a few years to make that decision, I think getting a pretty good telescope is sage advice if that's what you're looking at doing. Some people are just going to go out, buy a telescope or two, and then like they're just going to use that instrument or make it or whatever, and that's awesome. But when I see people who again are on that train of buying, selling, and going through that process, which can end up costing a lot of money trying to see something. For example, the thing that always strikes me is the Mars test, because Mars is so difficult to observe, and there's really, very particular telescopes that are going to give those images, because you need the telescope sort of able to focus the red sort of very supremely, and it is difficult to get such an instrument. But I think those Takahashis, like I was out using mine last night, and the DC 100 is just perfect for that. And it is a little bit more expensive than some of the other instruments you're going to get. But at the same time, when I see people that are buying like an affordable 5-inch Parker mat, and maybe a 6-inch and a 3-inch and all these different ones, sometimes I might be saying, well, why don't you just go buy a Tac 4-inch, and then you'll be able to see what you want to see, and then you can buy like a larger instrument, like a 10 or 12 inch Dob. I think is a nice combination to have, and not crazy expensive either. But yeah, I do always get worried when I see people who are buying sort of a seamlessly endless stream of different telescopes, trying to sort of achieve this budgetary optimal instrument that's going to beat like this better telescope that neither of which ever exist.
Yeah, the old adage of you get what you pay for sometimes, or definitely applies to a lot of astronomy gear. Now, there certainly are some good performers at low price points, but when you start reaching those other levels, you'll definitely notice a little, or sometimes substantial differences.
Yeah, for sure. For sure. I think so. And I don't think the premiums are that high now. And I'm not talking about people that are just getting an instrument and then they're going to use that instrument. And that's totally fine. Like, that's not what I'm referring to. Or nor am I saying that people should go out and buy something that's very expensive. And I get it. I'm just saying that if people are on that path, that sort of upgrade train to Brooksville kind of thing, I call it. Then yeah, just go out and do that. Just go out and buy that instrument that will give you those views. I've talked to several listeners over the years, and many of our listeners seem to be very open to that. And when deciding, on this, that, or the other telescope, I just know that when they go to use it, they're going to say, okay, but what's that next level, right? And it used to be better, it used to be worse because you only ever in the past, 25 years ago and earlier, you only just had like your Takahashis and your astrophysics and maybe a few others. And then that was it. However, we've had a lot of other great little telescope makers pop up that produce really awesome instruments. And they're wonderful instruments, don't get me wrong. And they're great, and they're probably all you'll ever need. But if you're somebody that's using one of those instruments, or maybe you started with an Achromat and then you're going to go to a semi-apo and then you're going to go to like a full apo, but that's a budget friendly apo, and then you're going to eventually want to have that other telescope. Like, you just see the path that somebody is on. They're spending, well, first they spent 250, then they spent 600, then they spent 1200. Now they're like, huh, what's the next thing I'm going to get? Well, the next thing is 2400, but they already spent $2400, right? So it's, to me, it always just makes sense. Just look at what you want for the long term. I mean, it's kind of what I did. I bought like one telescope, then I bought my semi-apo for pretty cheap, and then I just saved up for 7 or 8 years, and then I bought my 5-inch Apochromat, which I still have. And then eventually, 14 years later, I bought another 4-inch Apochromat. And that's kind of my story with it. But anyway, getting on. That's my gear advice. Maybe too much gear advice. I thought you would have more gear advice, Shane, but you were much wiser than
Don't know about
am.
that, but good conversation.
Anything to add?
Nope, that's all.
Thanks for listening, everybody. Please subscribe, share the show with other stargazers you know. Send us your observations and questions and show ideas like Royce did. Thanks for this, Royce, to actualastronomy@gmail.com.
Thank you, everyone, for listening, and we hope you enjoyed the show. If you are interested in more information, would like to contact us, or if you would like to support the podcast, check out our website, actualastronomy.com.